Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. As I said last week, I am in Buffalo, New York. This is, I guess I've been here now 8 days, 9 days, and this is home for the near future. Today's show, if you saw our promotion, is about the conference that took place last week in Houston, Texas. Recall we did a show not quite a month ago about this upcoming conference, and we had some of the people on who were Seresta Smith, Ruth Rodriguez, and Zach Rodriguez. We had them on talking about the upcoming conference. And today we are going to talk to some other members of the organization about the conference itself. We've got some people who are new to the War Report, and we've got two who have been on War Report previously. So with that, let me get right to our guest, and I'm going to start with Denisha, Dr. Denisha Jones, since this is your first time on the War Report. Welcome to the War Report, Denisha.
Thank you for having me, James.
Won't you give a short bio of yourself?
Sure. I'm currently an assistant professor in education at Trinity Washington University. I had spent the past 5 years teaching in the School of Education at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and then recently moved over to Trinity. I've been with United Opt Out for about 3 years now. I've been attending many of their events since 2011 in D.C., and officially joined the board about 2 years ago. And I currently am also on the board of the Badass Teachers Association and defending the early years.
Zach?
Sure. Thanks for having me again, Jim. I am currently a teacher in Houston, in the Houston Independent School District. I've been teaching here now for 4 years. I am on the executive board of the Houston Federation of Teachers. This will be my second year heavily involved with the union. Recently, we have filed a lawsuit against the Houston Independent School District over the teacher evaluation system. And we can get into that a little bit later on.
Okay, Gus?
Hey, how you doing, James? Long time no hear.
Yeah, it has been a long time, and it's your fault.
It is my fault. I apologize. So my background, as you know, I'm from Holyoke, Massachusetts. I'm a public school teacher in Massachusetts. I'm heavily involved with all things union and labor. I sit on the board of directors for United Opt Out and Badass Teachers Association.
Oh, I didn't know that you were on both of Badass. That's right, I did know that. Take that back. And our last guest.
Hi, I'm Erica Chavarria. I'm a high school Spanish teacher in Howard County, Maryland, right outside of Baltimore City. I'm on the board of directors of my local union, an NEA affiliate, the Howard County Education Association. I'm also on the Human and Civil Rights Committee of the Maryland Education Association, and was on a task force for the National Education Association for school-to-prison pipeline and school discipline. I've also been heavily involved in Save Our Schools Coalition, and recently joined the board for United Opt Out.
All right. We're going to start by talking about how the idea for the Houston conference came about, to give everyone a sort of a glimpse into the background of what that conference was hopefully was going to be. And then we'll get into the conference itself and the title of this show is The Lessons Learned, so we'll talk about that. So who want to start with the background?
This is Denisha. I can start for quickly and then have others chime in. So as you probably heard when you had Seresta Smith on the show, she was the one who really suggested Houston as a location. She had been working in the past with Beth Papo, who's head of the Houston Federation of Teachers. She had went down there. She knew that the opt-out movement was growing in Houston. And she was also aware that part of what we wanted to do at United Opt-Out was to really push back against the civil rights groups who have promoted an opposition to anti-testing. They've actually opposed opt-out and keep making demands that we have annual testing in grades 3-8 and again in high school. And so part of the reasoning for the event was that we needed to go to diverse places that were doing opt-out and then also push back against this narrative that somehow more testing is what is needed in Black and brown communities. And so she suggested Houston as that location. And Ruth and I, you know, worked with her, and then we partnered with Zeph and with Zach, and we brought us on board, and then that's why we ended up in Houston this time around.
Okay.
Yeah, Denisha was getting to the growing opt-out movement here in Houston. The Houston Federation of Teachers, back in March, we endorsed the United Opt-Out mission of opting out as a tactic of fighting back against the corporatization of education. Locally, I had three of my own high school kids opted out last year. They were the first ones in the city of Houston to do so. And this year, at the high school level, we've been pushing it more and more. And when they reached out to us, locally in the HFT, we endorsed them, and I came in contact with Denisha and Seresta, and we've been working on the conference since, I guess, about April or so, April or May, and we had it last weekend.
What was the real driving force for wanting to have this conference, inviting the people that you reached out to, and take it from that point? I think that's important for people to know.
Sure.
One of the goals we tried to do was to invite leaders from the civil rights organizations that had signed on to the anti-testing statement. So we reached out to the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, the NAACP, LULAC and LaRaza and other organizations that were prominent on there to first try and get them to attend this event with a representative so we can, in an effort to kind of discuss why we think their anti-testing efforts are wrong-headed for civil rights organizations to be taking that position. Unfortunately, none of them, you know, wanted to attend an event where they knew that they would be, that their thoughts were not being supported, right? They didn't, most of the feedback was, well, you know, we can't send someone down there to defend our position and that sort of thing. So in the end, we didn't get that representation that we hopefully were able to get, but what we did get were a lot of the local Houston folks who did come to talk about the work they're doing at the event, which was really helpful to kind of frame the picture of what's happening on the ground.
What were some of the organizations that you issued invitations to besides the NAACP?
The NAACP, I think, Zach, did you speak directly to someone? So I don't know what they...
We sent feeders out. We sent invitations to local chapters of the NAACP. As Denisha said, the NAACP, La Raza, and we didn't get any responses. And we really shouldn't be surprised. These are people who ostensibly support civil rights, but they only support it within a framework that reinforces corporate control. So what they really support is corporate domination, and they support people that parrot that message. And we clearly don't. So in hindsight, it really shouldn't surprise us that they didn't show up. But in that regard, we did have, I think we are having a little bit of success when we were able to push the NAACP to at least adopt a moderate stance against charter schools, which is a small step. But it's
a national effort, you know, of many groups who are pushing that NAACP that route. And we believe that that's why we see an opening here. Now that they've come out against charter school to put a moratorium on the expansion of charter school, can we now work with them on their stance on testing, right? And so we really did see it as a way to open the door to this conversation, which is much needed.
Let me add this.
Sure.
Was it a year ago, possibly a few months more, that 30 civil rights groups, or put it this way, supposedly civil rights groups who signed on to this statement saying that testing was a civil rights issue and that to not test was a violation of the student's civil right to be tested. And that was, am I correct, it was almost 30 organizations that signed on, United Way, you name it. There was a whole list of groups that in the past have been the ones that we looked to and counted on to fight for our human and civil rights. So of this, if you sent out invitation to that body, you're talking over 30 or at least 30 organizations. Is that the body that you sent your invitation to?
Yeah.
Got response?
On that list, it actually, the list that we used with the final was 19 groups, and it was a combination of NAACP groups, Latino organizations, disability organizations, and women's groups. And we did focus just on the African-American civil rights groups and the Latino civil rights groups for that, for this event. So we didn't target everyone on that list, but I know Samantha Smith and Ruth Rodriguez and Zach, all, and I reached out to some folks as well, too. We sent out personal invitations to people we knew who represented the NAACP in different chapters, who also represented LULAC, and the La Raza group, who was also another group that signed on, and the Leadership Council itself. So those are at least four groups for sure that signed on to that list that we invited to this event.
And what about United Way? I mean, I know you said you just identified the groups that you sent out.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to that list that I was referring to when you had United Way on it. And I would also say the Congressional Black Caucus, who have come out, well, at least the Congressional Black Caucus, as we have known it in the past, has now split in terms of you have many of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus who are now corporate Dems, third way Dems, and you still have some caucus members who are clinging to the traditional role of the Black caucus member fighting for equal rights, social justice, economic justice, et cetera. Those groups you didn't reach out to. And one more piece here, and that is I'm talking national groups. Zach, I think you said you reached out to a lot of local NAACP groups as well
Correct.
As a national.
Correct. Correct. We sent out plenty of feelers, both locally and nationally, and that's how these organizations work. If they'll send someone locally, usually this person does represent them nationally. If you look at all these other events that they attend, they don't have any problem sending somebody from a local office to represent them nationally. It's quite simple. They simply do not want to take a stand against their corporate master. That's all there is to it. It's plain and simple. Whenever you take a stand against the people that pay your bills, you run the risk of losing their favor. And that's why, even though the NAACP came out against charter schools, it's a very moderate stance. They're saying they don't want They're saying they don't want the extension of charter schools. They have not come out in opposition to charter schools in principle. That's a totally different stance. And why not? Because a lot of the NAACP funding comes from people like the Waltons, the Bill Gateses of the world, and so on and so forth. They're corporate controller. So it's really not a surprise that they're not going to support people who are taking a stand for themselves in opposition to the corporate agenda. It's really not that big of a surprise.
And just to piggyback on what Gus said, I mean, the Beck said, I think we've seen the fallout of this decision. As soon as they said they wanted to, a local chapter decided to vote on a moratorium on charter schools and bring it to the national. We saw a lot of the pushback, and so definitely some opposition there. But to your point, about...
Anisha, are you on a speakerphone?
Yes.
Please go to your handset.
Okay.
Okay, that's much better.
Okay. And then, again, so we selected you. There are multiple different civil rights organizations in different letters. There was a specific letter published on May 5th of 2015 that says, civil rights groups, we oppose anti-testing efforts. On that list, the Congressional Black Caucus had not signed on to that statement. So that is one of the reasons why we did. I agree with you what you said about their positions and how we do need to work with, but we were specifically targeting the organizations on this list.
Okay.
And that's what it comes down to. They have a very specific agenda, and they're aware that if they step outside that agenda, there's going to be consequences for them. They're aware of that. And everybody else should be as well.
Gus and Erica? Any comments?
What exactly would you like to know, James?
I'm sorry, Gus, you go ahead. I'll follow up.
I mean, as far as the civil rights organizations are concerned, you know, I've been troubled for a long time about their stances on a lot of things, not just the testing, but what they see as civil rights issues with public schools. And a lot of them are getting their information from outside of public school sources, and that to me is problematic from the get-go. The idea that you can receive information about public education from people who don't work in public education, who are not working with students day in and day out, is problematic. And so a lot of the stances, including testing, including charter schools, and I'm not talking about just the NAACP, I'm talking about the Latino organizations like LULAC and National Council of La Raza, they are problematic because I'm not sure that they're really representative of what we are talking about as a whole. When something works specifically for a very small portion of the population, you cannot generalize that as having worked for the entire population. So if you take over an entire school district and you overflow with all these things that may or may not work, and I'm not even going to concede that any of these things work, including testing, including charter schools, including the digital learning that we're seeing the proliferation of. But if you do that and then you say it could work for everybody, that's not realistic, because the district that I live in Holyoke, Massachusetts, is a very, very impoverished district where we don't get a lot of funds. So a lot of these things that they're saying work, we've already had decades of experience where it has not worked. As a matter of fact, some people might say, and I'm included, that it has actually had a negative effect on our population. Specifically here in Holyoke, we have a very strong Puerto Rican population, and here it has been detrimental. We have not advanced in any way. We have not overcome any kind of gaps, and that's a whole other conversation. But for our national civil rights organizations to stand there and say that testing is here for accountability when we've had two decades of it and zero accountability, to me, just doesn't seem really transparent or really like what they're meaning to say.
Erica?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is that historically they've been fed these lines of you know, accountability, that testing is going to hold as a way of holding teachers accountable for the success of all students, including students of color. We, the teachers that are on the ground that are having to facilitate the testing and teach to the test, really understand that that's not the case, that the high-stakes testing is actually one of the driving forces that leads to pushing students, particularly Black and brown students, out of school, and ultimately, in many cases, into the juvenile justice system. So, you know, the idea of, like, this idea that charter schools give parents a choice so that their students of color particularly are going to be given options for better environments in the school setting and a way of holding teachers accountable, we on the ground know, as Gus was saying, that these things do not work. And not only do they not work, but they are particularly impacting negatively students of color, our Black and brown students. And it's one of the two of the most driving factors in pushing Black and brown students out of school and into the juvenile justice system, leading to the school to prison pipeline. And so we need to, you know, if we can work with these civil rights organizations to really understand what the true impact is on the students that they're actually trying to advocate for, what they're supposed to be advocating for. That it's actually the opposite of what is happening. So
now, each of you have pretty much echoed kind of the same thing, that we want to reach out to these organizations. As I said earlier, organizations that for decades prior to No Child Left Behind and the formal declaration of war on public education, teachers, students, and parents were legendary for their fight for the working class, what was left of the middle class, the poor class, for equal rights, and et cetera. Now, come No Child Left Behind, come the out-and-out declaration of war, and these are my words, on public education, as I just said, by the organizations that you ultimately sent your invitations to. It was when I heard about this, I talked to a couple members of the organization who are very, very, very close friends and family to me. I was thinking, what are you guys thinking? And I thought of something that I used to hear my mother say all the time. She used to say, zebras don't change their stripes, meaning these groups that you guys were reaching out to, there was no way in hell, I thought, you're going to get them to come, and if they came, that you were going to be able to have an honest dialogue with them and change minds, change opinions. So let's move now to the conference. You sent out your invitations, and the people that you sent, the organization that you sent out your invitations to, none of them came. And that, I think it was Zach, you said you weren't surprised. How about the rest of you?
No, Tanisha, I wasn't surprised either. I mean, I think I understand your thought. Why would you do this? Because you have to at least try to do it before you say it doesn't work. I was learning about I went to a workshop in law school, and they were talking about a theory about getting around whether, you know, there's something in the law about disparate impact, and you have to know intentionally approve that they were doing it, that they were creating that disparate impact. And so one of the ways they're getting around that is to go to these organizations that are doing this and tell them the harmful effects of what they're doing. And then if they fail to then change course, then you can legally say that they are aware of the effects and they're doing it anyway, and you can prove it. And so that was my thinking behind this as well. We are now, no one came, and we were understanding that they weren't going to come, but we still wanted to push forward and have an organizing meeting where we developed a statement that really showed what the unintended or possibly intended consequences are of a lot of these corporate reforms that they are supporting, especially around testing. And putting the statement out there now and saying, this is the reality of what you're saying, you're supporting more testing. This is what testing is doing. And if you don't change course, then you can't call yourself a civil rights organization when you're putting forth practices that hurt children and their families. And so now we are in a position to be able to do that and to say that. But first, we have to at least say, come and have this conversation. And we tried, and they didn't come. And now we're going to put out our statement, compiling all of what we know, what you've talked about, what all of us know are the results of testing in Black and brown communities, putting it out there in a place for them to see, and now challenging them to either change or admit that they're supporting policies that are harmful to the communities they're supposed to serve. And I think, I mean, that's my take on what we were doing at the conference and where we go next.
Let me add something here. That law principle that you spoke of earlier came out of the various cases that got to the Supreme Court as relates to civil rights issue. And the bottom line was that, was there intent, or whether or not the outcome was unintended, and thus if it was unintended, then there was no violation of the fourth, fifth, maybe amendment. I have to.
Yes, the 14th, Equal Protection.
14th, right. And so it's very interesting that you would use that framework, because it literally came out of cases that involved some of the organizations that you just mentioned, in terms of when they were trying to bring about change and they were arguing of the harmful effect. And you now, I mean, maybe to you and I, this really ironic, because we know what we're talking about is related to the law and the history of it and something, but it's just so ironic to me that when you framed it,
Before we get bogged down in this conversation about intended versus unintended consequences, I think that's really beside the point. That can be discussed.
You do. That's interesting. I
think it is. I think it's really beside the point because the real point is that it's happened. Now, whether or not they wanted it to happen, that's a philosophical debate for a seminar class on a college campus. The reality is that kids are dealing with it every day, and that is what the problem is. And by them saying, well, by them I'm referring to these civil rights organizations, by them saying, well, this wasn't our intent or things have gone wrong, that's merely an attempt to put lipstick on a pig. The reality is it's out of control. That's the reality on the ground. So regardless of whether they intended for that or not is beside the point. It doesn't matter whether you intended for a lot of people to die and a lot of people to be robbed of an opportunity. They are and they were. That's all that matters. For the people that are locked up on death row, it doesn't matter if they weren't intended to be locked up. Their life is still over. They were locked up.
No, Zach. In the law, intent means everything. So I understand what you're saying in relation to children, but in the law, intent is a big part of proving issues related to legal. And I was just referencing a legal theory that I had learned about and how it was applied and which framed my thinking and what we were doing here with the civil rights groups and what we shared, right? That once you show the consequences of your actions, you can no longer claim to not have known what was happening, right? To no longer say it. You can't say that once it's known, and then it changes the argument, and it changes how you push back. So, yeah, this is not really a discussion on the law, and intent, but intent is important sometimes when that's happening. But we are assuming that these are the unintended consequences, even though many of us believe that not necessarily the civil rights group's intention, but the corporatization intention, right? It's clear what they want to do with public education, and they're not hiding it, and the results are not really unintended in that sense. But we are approaching it and saying that these are the unintended consequences of school testing and privatization, and they're harming these communities. And if you keep putting forth that you support these things, then how dare you call yourself a civil rights organization?
And Zach, I would add, and we will move on to another subject, but I would add I profoundly disagree with you in that, back as Denisha was saying, in terms of law, there's some other principles here too. And Denisha, I think you would agree with me here on, you judge will tell you, you knew or you should have known.
Yes.
And two, ignorance is no excuse before the law. I would further add that, as you just stated, Denisha, they knew. They knew damn well what their intent was and what the consequences would be, and they've achieved all of that. Now, that's what you want to call it, a philosophical argument that would be on a college campus. I would say you are, in my opinion, wrong. Okay, let's move on. Now we're at the conference, and you're finding that the people that you wanted to come didn't come, but the people who came, what did you learn? Because the title of this is Lessons from Houston. So what did you learn?
Yeah, go ahead, Erica. No. So, I think as someone who, was invited, and then ultimately by the end of the conference, I felt confident enough to want to join on the board of directors of United Opt Out because of the work that was done during the conference and the confidence I had that what we're doing is moving in the right direction. And I think a lot of that was because of the policy that or the stance that we took and the statement that we wrote. And I feel like it's going to be a process, and I know that a lot of the larger unions have been talking with the civil rights organizations for quite a while now on the harmful effects of testing, and you know, they're not budging on their stances, of course, because a couple of reasons, but because of the corporatization and the fact that they're taking money from big corporations. But I think one of the main things that was inspirational at the meeting while we were there was when, and although, Zach, I know that you said it's not perfect and it's not enough, but the fact that the NAACP did put out their moratorium on charters and made that stance, and we were together when we found out the news, and although that's not, it's not a perfect stance, it's a start, and I think it was actually monumental, and it's because of the work of people like G2 Brown from Journey for Justice and Reverend William Barber from the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, and the work that they've been doing working with education activists and really having those conversations that the NAACP ultimately made this decision to put out a public stance on charters. And I think that, that the lesson learned is that we can't give up. And I think we came up with a very solid statement with positions that I feel are, especially with the implementation of ESSA, where it's largely left on the states now to deal with the issues that before was a national thing. Now it's going to be left to states. I think that the statement that we came up with and the policy, what we came up with, is really representative of the various issues that we're facing. And I think we can't give up. And that was the biggest lesson I learned. I felt really inspired by the people that were there. I think we all have really great goals in mind. We touched on a lot of issues, and I think that the inclusion of the racial justice and social justice aspects of testing, and not just testing, but school-to-prison pipeline and school discipline policies that are harmful to students and charter schools and the harm that charter schools are doing to our students, I think that we were able to kind of come up with a really solid document that we can't give up on. And I think just hearing about the NAACP's stance during the time when we were there, for me, was really inspirational, and I'm excited to move forward, and I think that we just can't give up. We can never give up, because who's at stake is our students, and if no one's doing it, who else is going to do it but us? And I think we have a great group of people working on it, and that was what I got most out of the conference.
Question, then, is individually, what did you learn, or was it a collective learning situation? Gus? Gus, you there? Anisha?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Now we can hear you.
Now we can.
Okay, sorry about that, James. So my answer to your question is I think there was some collective learning and some individual learning. As far as the individual learning, for me, on a very personal level, it was nice to see that there was even an opt-out movement in Houston. Very specifically, we had one of the original opt-out members from the Houston area. She attended the conference, and the story about that movement really inspired me. And I can't speak for anybody else. I'm sure they were touched as well. But what they told us about their experience and how much fighting they had to do just to get one student to opt out and then two or three or four was really motivating for me. Because if they were able to have enough fortitude to take on the forces that they had to, which pretty much meant the entire district on their back, and they still accomplished what they set out to do, and they did some things which I'll let Anisha or Erica or Zach talk about the actual, I think they called it opt-out academy. But mm-hmm. for me, it was definitely a really good experience to see that there's people in all walks of life, black, brown, white, that are involved in this movement and really spreading the word.
Yeah, for me, individually, I felt like I learned, well, for me, individually, it was really about the lawsuits. We had a presentation by Beth Capo and Audrey Dersleed about the lawsuits against value-added measures in Texas and in New Mexico. And so being in law school, you know, this was really fascinating for me to hear how they're, and really want to see the outcome of these arguments, and if they can make these case that these lawsuits are, that there's some constitutional issues with them. But collectively, I think for those of us who've been in United Opt-Out, you know, even though, you know, Gus and Zach and Eric are new, you know, they know Opt-Out. We know Opt-Out. We've been knowing it for a long time. But we had no idea that these folks in Houston, maybe Zach did because he lives in Houston, but that they had created Opt-Out Academy. So they picked a week where most of the tests are being given and created a space for children to come and learn and do interesting work because they weren't taking the test. And to me, that's amazing. You know, people want to say the opt-out movement is dead or the opt-out movement is obsolete, but it's not. It's not in these communities where these people are actually showing us what you can do when you work together, like parents and retired teachers and teacher assistants spending a week creating a curriculum for first three children the first year around and then 30 children the second year around who are opting out of the test in their area. I mean, to me, that is just how we push opt-out to the next level, especially in black and brown communities where we know parents can't just keep their kids at home because they have to go to work. They need a place to send their child if their child's going to opt out. So if we really look into this idea, and they've created an opt-out academy how-to guide in Houston and have it on their website. I mean, that to me was one of the biggest take one of the things we learned is that how we can structure the opt-out movement to be more supportive of Black and Brown communities through the development of these opt-out academies would be awesome.
That is awesome.
Sure.
Very much so. I got a smile on my face.
To elaborate on what Denisha and Gus and Erica were all getting at, these opt-out academies were created and they're still operating and they're still growing by a group of local activists, some of whom I've worked with before, known as Community Voices for Public Education. And that's exactly what they are. They're a community organization who promotes an effective method of education and a different form of education, a form of education that truly allows the child to grow and develop and pursue their interests and pursue their curiosities in all facets. And that's what real education is about. And these folks have done wonderful work. They're continuing to do wonderful work. And, in fact, they are the ones who helped bring HFT and UOO together. And that's a huge step. Those connections that are made are very important, especially when you're talking about such a monumental task like fighting against the most powerful institutions in the world now, which are American corporations. So making those connections is very important, and I think was a very big success. And it's something that I took away also. Even though I knew most of the people that were there, I did take away that these people that like Denisha and Erica and CVPE were all fighting the same battle. And part of making the battle even stronger is to not fight alone, to get to overcome this atomization of society that corporations like. So making those connections, I think, was a very big success.
Just add in something. This is Erica. Something that I definitely took away as well by hearing from community members and parents about the Opt-Out Academy and the work that the communities in Houston are doing. Here in Maryland, we have a very weak opt-out movement, and by weak, I mean pretty much zero opt-out. Non-existent. We're not even able to call it opt-out. We call it refuse. Very little people know that they have the ability to refuse their children from the test. It's very hard to do so. I've had to do it. I've had to speak personally with the principal and had a lot of backlash for my stepson who he's in high school, but at the time was attending middle school. And as part of my local union here, we did at the Howard County Education Association, we actually did a listening campaign recently to find out what the concerns of our community members and parents and students were in terms of our schools. And one of the things that came out of that was an agenda that we created based on what we had heard from our community members. And the top one of the top concerns that we heard in our community is the testing concern. Parents and community members are very upset with the amount of testing that's going on, and yet we have no opt-out movement at all. And so for me, to hear about the Opt-Out Academy and to hear about what people are doing around the state and to know that the opt-out movement is not dead and to know that there are people that are doing things that are incredibly successful in terms of opting out, I feel like I can take those strategies now back to my own community, to the parents that I know, to the community members that I know are concerned about the amount of testing that's going on, and use those tools and strategies to move my community in the right direction in terms of refusing the test. Now I have a way to say, look, it can be done. It's being done here. It's being done here. And this is how we can do it. I know this is a concern of yours. It's on our agenda now. It's an agenda that we're presenting to our local school board with the backing of the community, which I think is one of the most important things. It's not just us as a union, a local union, or just the educators saying that we're sick of testing. It's all of us. It was the agenda created by the community. And so that was something really great for me to know that I now have tools and I have success stories and inspirational stories to take back to my parents and to my community members to show them that we can start a movement here and it is possible.
Well, I'm really inspired by the Academy, so much so that I'm going to be talking to people here in Buffalo about looking further into the Academy structure and use that as hopefully something that will motivate the parents to seriously consider opt-out here and actually get engaged. Because here in Buffalo, very anemic opt-out movement, extremely anemic for a city, the second largest city in the state of New York. So I didn't get to the conference because I was in the process of moving, but that's something that I will take away from this show, which is a sort of like indirect attendance at the conference. That makes
sure.
sense.
And if you would like the information, Jim, or anybody else listening would like the information, you can simply Google search Community Voices for Public Education, and it brings up their work. It brings up their website. They have that stuff laid out. They do have a very active Facebook page. They're very active locally. People, like I said, I've worked with some of them before. They're very active at school board meetings. And they're in it for their own children. These are not people that are, you know, these are not professional staff working for some corporation who send their kids to private school. These people
Zach,
are
say
working
it again
with their
slowly.
Children.
Say the
sure.
organization
if you,
slowly.
Sure. Can you hear me better? Okay. The Community Voices of Public Education, if you just Google
Community Voices of Public Education.
Correct. Community yes. Voices of okay. Public Education. They have a very active Facebook page. They're very active here locally, but they also do make those connections, like we made at the conference, with people outside of Houston to help establish better methods of education.
Good, good. Denisha, what did you take
yes.
away?
I took away, again, the App.Dot Academy is great. We also ended the event with a talk from Sam Abrams, who is a director at Columbia University. He directs, I'm going to mangle the name because I don't know it exactly, but it's a center that studies the effects of privatization on education. And he has a new book out, and so he gave a talk about his book and really looking at this whole idea of this model of corporatization, how and why it doesn't work for education. And I think it's something we all know intuitively. You can't treat schools like business, you know. Children aren't products or parents aren't consumers. But to really see in a well-researched way why it doesn't work and looking at it historically, I think really helps strengthen our arguments when we say that, because it's not so much that parents can't be consumers, but one of the big points of this presentation was that children, as the consumers of education, have no way to evaluate whether their product works or not. When I buy something on Amazon and I find out I don't like it, I have lots of options, you know, ask for a refund, put a bad review, send the product back. Children getting an education have no recourse, so you can't have them as consumers of a good. You can't have education as a commodity, because there's no way for the people who have the most direct connection to it to actually evaluate whether it's good or not as a product. And so to me, that was really helpful to kind of structure that argument that we all say, why can't schools be run as a business? Because we know this is what the corporatization model is. All public services need to be privatized and outsourced, and to really destroy the local government or the federal government from having any control over those things. But we know certain things shouldn't be privatized, like public education, like prisons, like healthcare, like water, right? And so how do we keep making these arguments
exactly.
why it doesn't work? And so that was really important that I took away at the end of the event. And I think most of the people in attendance really did enjoy hearing the research that Sam's been doing for years on this issue.
Can you, before the show is over, look up the exact title and give it to
sure.
us of that?
Yeah, the title of the institute. It's called the Center for the Study of Privatization of Education, the Center for the Study of Privatization in Education at Columbia University. Denisha recently just said, he did publish a new book called Education and the Commercial Mindset, which has been reviewed just recently in Teachers College Press, will be reviewed in the New York Review of Books pretty soon. And he is making this argument that Denisha said, that you cannot privatize something that you can't possibly know the outcome of it. And if you do that, what you're really doing is not just destroying education, but you're really destroying one of the last few democratic institutions in America. Democracy is not simply voting. Democracy is how much control you have over your own personal life. And education is one of the last places where people do have a substantial amount of control over their personal life. And part of what we're doing is to help people realize that. And opting out is one method of that. The opt-out academies is one method of that. So these things are not just education. They're also about what kind of society you want to live in. If you're serious about living in a democratic society, then you have to oppose things like
the corporatization of education, you have to oppose things like the destruction of public infrastructure in terms of water. You have to oppose things like locking up poor people that can't afford to pay bail money because they were going 10 miles over the speed limit. You know, you got to stop this kind of thing. And this is simply part of that.
You know, that's what the War Report is all about. I'm one of the most anti-privatization of everyone and everything, humanity and the planet, on the planet. And I will definitely will reach out to the author of that book and invite him to come on the show, because privatization is what this show started, that made me start this show, was my recognition of we were all being privatized individually, collectively, all of humanity and the planet, and what I consider the threat to both humanity and the planet as a result of the effort to privatize it. We've got about 5-6 minutes left. Let's have everyone go around in terms of where do we go from here based upon what you've learned. I know you said there's a document coming out. I'm assuming that you're not at liberty to discuss it in any kind of detail, but can you say individually where, based on lessons learned, where do you go from here? We got 5 minutes.
Sure. I think we'll just keep organizing. We'll keep talking to more people. We keep inviting more people to our events. We keep promoting opt-out, not only locally, but nationally. We keep making these connections with folks like yourself. For example, with me, I didn't know Denisha 5 months ago. You keep making these connections with people, and you keep building the movement on the ground. There's not a magic pill. It's just hard work on the day-to-day, talking to more people, bringing them involved, and helping people organize. And I think that's the only way forward.
Denisha?
Yeah, for me, we're definitely working on this statement, which we can't share now, but we will be able to once it's finished. We have to go through several rounds of editing and make sure that everybody who was there and participated comes to consensus on the final wording. And so once we issue that, there'll be a press release to the statement, and that we'll definitely send it out to all of those groups who signed on to the. There's a new statement out by civil rights groups in ESSA, which also calls for more testing. So any of those groups and the groups in the past will be identified and signed on to those. To that statement to send it out. And then the next step, I think, comes holding them accountable, right? So we sent you the statement, we've addressed this, you don't want to come hear us talk, you keep pushing this. What ways can we now hold you accountable for the position you're taking and how it's harmful? And I think, like Zach said, we organize around that issue as well, too. Like, how do we really come out and say, you know, this is not okay? Because if you think about it, like, even in political campaigns, I know Bernie Sanders, you know, anyone who was campaigning for president really can't come out against something that 19 civil rights groups are for. So it's a really political issue, right? Because if they're putting out this statement saying they want testing every year, and then we get a politician to say we should do away with standardized testing, they're going to be attacked as being against civil rights groups. And so we need to really attack that whole message and really be clear that what they're advocating for is wrong and harmful, and how do we really hold them accountable for that? And then I think personally for me, we'll definitely be looking at growing out opt-out academies and other areas as a way to really increase opt-out in black and brown communities.
Erica?
I think definitely making sure that we're expanding our work around the many issues that are occurring all at the same time. We obviously have our focus on opting out in terms of high-stakes testing. Like I said, I know with ESSA that the testing is going to start looking a little different, and it's going to be a fight with state by state as opposed to what was a national fight. And I think just making sure that we're working with community organizations that are doing work already around various states and making sure that we're lending support to organizations around different states and local unions so that we're addressing the issues, because it's going to start being a state-to-state battle, and states that have, states that aren't supported are going to be losing those battles very quickly. So making sure that we're working in collaboration with other organizations that are doing some of the same work that we are, but also making sure that we're maintaining a focus of who we are as an organization independently as well. But, you know, like everyone said, just continuing the organizing, continuing to put pressure on the civil rights organizations that we really need to flip their script and start really understanding the harmful effects that the testing and all these other things have on our students, particularly our students of color.
Gus, I saved you for last as punishment for you and I not.
I appreciate it, James. So for me, you know, what I've noticed about the opt-out movement nationally is that it's fragmented, it's disjointed in terms of who it's representing. So we do have a lot of suburban middle-class families who are predominantly white who are opting out, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But what we also have are pockets of black and brown resistance throughout the country, but they are not united on a national scene. And so I see United Opt-Out as a vehicle for uniting all groups and bringing together one common message about opting out and what opting out means in order to really liberate certain communities. And I speak mostly of communities of color, but realistically, I'm talking about the entire country who's in the grips of just testing culture and evaluation culture, which is tied to testing culture, and zero tolerance discipline. It's all tied together. And so I see us as the conduit of information and really creating something a little more mainstream where everybody knows exactly where to look for, and we're not fighting 50 different battles, and instead we're fighting one gigantic battle together.
Reflection for one moment. And Zach, you really set the tone when you first came on air in terms of you were disappointed, but you totally expected that you would not get the response that you were, you being the collective you were looking for as relates to the organizations that you wanted to come to have this dialogue with. The rest of you, did you really expect them to show up, and were you disappointed on any level that they didn't show?
I never really had an expectation. And at the same time, I'm not really disappointed because I know what work we have ahead of us. I know it's going to be daunting work. I know it's going to be near impossible, and I know that we're going to have a lot of obstacles. But all we can do, like Erica said prior, is all we can do is try, and we can keep trying and never give up.
Denisha?
Yeah, I didn't expect it. I tried. I did have a personal connection with someone at the Leadership Council, one of my law professors, and, you know, had reached out. I was hoping that, like Zach had said, if the national people didn't come, maybe a few local people would have at least shown up, like, just to hear what was being said. I thought that was a possibility. But, again, I think it showed why we had to do this, the fact that they didn't come. And it really just fortifies the position that this needs to be addressed, right? If they had come, then I think it would be, you know, we'd be in a position to say, well, at least they came to hear us out. They just don't agree with us. But I think it puts us in a better position to say, you know, we made these invitations, they didn't come, and this is where we move forward. And again, a lot of people question why do you even care what civil rights groups? And I don't think every black and brown person in the community, you know, goes around listening to what they say, but their words do matter, and they influence policy, and elected officials look to these groups. So I think the message they send is important, and it's important that we address it as an organization that is opposed to the message that they're putting out and you know, in any way they can. So I'm not disappointed that they didn't come. I think it left us free to work and to do really amazing work in that space because they weren't there, and we were able to just, you know, discuss all the things that we know in our heart to be true and to define ways to support it, you know, with or without them. But it puts us in a stronger position, I think, to make this message.
Erica, you got the last word.
I wasn't surprised. I don't think even at this point I can say I'm disappointed. It just shows, like Denisha was saying, the work that needs to be done and the fight that we need to continue fighting. I do think that there's hope, and I think that that's something that continues my drive forward, and I think is going to continue the drive forward for United Opt Out. Is that again with the NAACP and that monumental step forward, even though it's not perfect, but it is a step. I do think that it is possible to change the minds and to get civil rights organizations on the right side of this issue. I think it's essential that we have their support eventually in the future, in order for change to be made. So, you know, it just shows the work that we need to do and continue doing that. And I think at the end of the day that there is hope, and that I'm going to keep looking towards that hope in what I do and what we do. And I think the people who are on this board and the people that who are working in United Opt Out, we have a really incredible group of people who each bring something powerful and dynamic to the stage, and I think working together we're going to get a lot accomplished.
Okay. I thank everyone, and especially those of you, this is your first time on our show. Hope you'll come back either individually or collectively again. And with that, everyone, I'm going to thank the audience for being back with me again. Our time is up. We'll see you next week. Thanks, everyone.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.